happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Hello, I'm Debbie Mackey.
And I'm Alan Mackey.
And we are your hosts on Left of Liberal, a program and a Facebook page we've created. Look for Left of Liberal with hosts Alan and Debbie Mackey. Also look for the White Teeth Poppy. We have a phone number at 512-517-2708 and an email, leftofliberal@outlook.com.
One of the main reasons we have undertaken doing this program, Left of Liberal, is because we feel very strongly peace and disarmament are central to most working class issues and form the basis for pulling together a massive, broad-based, all-people's front comprising liberals, progressives, and leftists, and many other people, irrespective of class, but the left oriented towards working class issues focused on anti-imperialism is going to be the catalyst in educating and organizing this all people's united front for peace and disarmament, for equality and social and economic justice, with socialism on the table now, not later. And also another reason for doing this program is because we want to create an atmosphere where working people feel free to, you know, sit around the kitchen table and in their union halls and church basements and begin to discuss these issues instead of allowing these overpaid pundits to determine how, you know, we think about things. So, you know, that's what our program is all about, empowering working people.
And you can listen to our program every Monday at 7 p.m. Central. Also, I'll give a plug to Stuart Alexander's program, 1 Hour Left. It's on Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Central. Also consider joining his Facebook page, Socialist Can, Connection Action Network. We also have a meeting. It's for the Socialist Connection Action Network. It's called Make a Difference. It'll be August 10th in Austin at the Live Oak Unitarian Church. There's an event. If you go on that page and join that page, you'll see the event, and just let us know if you're interested or if you think you can come. Now, I guess
what we should probably mention that Stuart Alexander is going to have a very special guest on his program this Wednesday, and that's Roderick Reed, the brother of Rodney Reed, who is on death row here in Texas, scheduled to be executed on November 20th. They've pushed up his date of execution because of the movement that's developing to support a new trial for Rodney Reed, and also to support a stay of execution and the exoneration of Rodney Reed, because everybody knows he didn't murder the person he's accused of murdering, that another person did the murder, and the person has been identified as Jimmy Fennell, a very crooked and corrupt and violent cop who has served prison time 10 years for raping and beating a woman who he had taken into custody while he was a sheriff's deputy. So, you know, Stuart's program is going to be a very important program, so I hope everybody will tune in. That's at 8 o'clock this Wednesday. And we'll have Roderick Reed on our program next week, too.
And then we can talk about some current events, what's going on with Puerto Rico.
Well, in Puerto Rico, there's hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets. We got to remember, Puerto Rico became a colony of the United States as part of the Spanish-American War. At the time that Puerto Rico became a colony of the United States, Cuba also became a colony, and that's going to tie in with our program tonight. Because when you compare Cuba and Puerto Rico, we see what colonialism and imperialism does to a country, and what socialism can do for a country and the peoples to free themselves from colonialism and imperialism. And the people of Puerto Rico have risen up, and they've gotten rid of one corrupt governor, and it looks like they want to install another corrupt governor, but the people of Puerto Rico will have a say. And also related to the program tonight, there's a lot of discussion in Puerto Rico. I've seen it all over the internet where the Puerto Rican people are talking about socialism. They're fed up with capitalism, and we're not getting that from the news media here in our country. no mention at all that the Puerto Ricans are carrying signs saying down with capitalism and they're for socialism. So, you know, we'll maybe get into some of that discussion tonight.
And then let's talk about health care.
Yeah, there's a lot of all these Democrats are coming up with their own health care programs. But every single one of these programs, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Kamala Harris or Joe Biden, all of their health care programs relate to the for-profit health care system. You know, and this is another example of how our free media manipulates people's minds and manipulates the discussion here in this country. You know, after all, there is another alternative to this whole health care mess, and that's the national public health care system. That means that health care should be publicly funded, publicly administered, and publicly delivered, just like public education. And the same model as public education, nothing controversial about it. The only thing controversial is that it cuts a lot of people who are making tremendous profits out of the health care system. So, you know, doctors and all these health care professionals should be on the public payroll, just like teachers and professors. And that's the solution to the healthcare mess. And none of the Democrats are talking about that because the left hasn't put this on the table. And we've got to do that.
And then we have a guest tonight, Rachel and Jake Tucker. They're from San Antonio. They're organizers and with the Party for Socialism and Liberation, also About Face Veterans Against the War. Rachel is a teacher and Jake is a hotel worker and a shop steward. And Rachel and Jake, are you on here?
Sure. Yes. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And what are these organizations about?
So Party for Socialism and Liberation is a revolutionary socialist party. We basically don't think that the crises and contradictions of capitalism are resolvable under our current system, and so we believe that it needs to be replaced with a socialist system, with a planned economy, proletarian or worker rule, and that the distribution of what we produce in this society should go to the people instead of the 1%, as it has been increasingly going to over the last, basically through the existence of the United States. So that's Party for Socialism and Liberation. We're going to talk about Face.
Yeah, About Face, Veterans Against the War, is a party. No, it's not a party. My bad. It's an organization that is made up or composed of soldiers from all different types of branches that enlisted and were in the military after 9/11. So it's a relatively young bunch that wants to make sense of what happened while they were in the military, and they have campaigns such as Drop the Mic, Drop the Military Industrial Complex, which is spreading awareness about the damage, the environmental, psychological, all sorts of social damages that war causes, and on our side and on the other side, and is spreading awareness about the budget, the military budget, which apparently recently was allowed to grow even more to $1.48 trillion. So we feel very passionately about both of our organizations, and as anti-imperialists, we have the party to organize and push people, and then we can also like practice that in About Face, where we're with veterans just like us that are trying to stop the militarism and from spreading even more.
Well, sounds like some good programs. That also, you made a trip to Cuba recently. That's what we've got you on the show for. What made you decide to go to Cuba and Did you go with a group, or and how long were you there?
Yeah, so we went to Cuba for 10 days, and it was, it felt like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I grew up in Miami, Florida, born and raised in Miami, and to Cuban parents, which, like, I'm basically Cuban. So I grew up with a lot of propaganda against Cuba and what their revolution, their socialist revolution is, and how the people are, and how the culture is. And so through the Party for Socialism and Liberation and Gloria Las Rivas, who also is part of this organization called the Cuban-Venezuela Coalition, we went as delegates, as two of 20 delegates. Some were reporters, some were journalists, some were party members from the PSL, some were friends of the PSL, activists, Answer Coalition, and in those 10 days, it was the program was jam-packed, and it was actually really, we were concerned about being allowed out of the country, because on June 5th, that's when Trump's new blockade and the travel people to people hadn't been initiated. So many of us that were getting our visas and tickets had to justify, like, why we were going and how and when we bought our tickets to be able to leave. Luckily, we didn't have any of those problems. But it was,
did you go by plane?
Yes.
Yeah, we flew out of Fort Lauderdale.
Oh, okay.
And so that, what Trump started, was it anybody that already had plans for trips could go, but nobody new can go? Is that what that is?
Yeah, as I understood it, and it worked for us, like anyone who had made a financial transaction regarding their trip prior to the date, what was it, June 4th or June 5th, was still allowed to go. But what Rachel's referring to is that message hadn't quite made its way down to the workers of Southwest and Fort Lauderdale exactly. And so when I was checking in for my ticket and all that, I didn't have any issues, but some of the people that we traveled with were getting a little more pushback from the workers at the desk at Southwest.
Yeah, because we would have to say we're traveling people to people. And for some reason, for some people, that wasn't good enough. And so they had to say supporting the Cuban people.
Yeah.
So now, the way it is now, are you saying that if you were to go again, you wouldn't be allowed to go as the way you went this time, or what?
I'm not 100% familiar with what exactly the law is now, but that's my understanding, is that we would not be able to travel to Cuba anymore.
Yeah.
Why do you think this government doesn't want people traveling to Cuba?
Cuba is, and you know, basically since the start of colonialism, Cuba has been possibly the most important island in the Caribbean, strategically, economically, and so on. Cuba, and you know, following the Spanish-American and Cuban War of 1898, Cuba and the U.S. had a special sweetheart deal/colonial relationship that allowed the United States, obviously, to have a base on Cuba, as we call Guantanamo, and as well as to basically intervene within their government at any time that they want, the U.S., that is. With the Platt Amendment. And so the U.S. used that amendment, I think, twice, occupying the island with the Marines. So, you know, as we do in so many other countries and across the world, but especially in the Caribbean and South America and Central America, we had basically used Cuba as our own plaything and puppet for decades leading up to the revolution. The revolution obviously upset that balance, but it wasn't necessarily the intention of the revolution to cut ties to the United States, because there's no interest in that for them. They just wanted to have sovereignty. They wanted the right to self-determine. And so the U.S., on the other hand, as we're seeing, you know, in Honduras and Venezuela and elsewhere, does not allow these half measures where they only get, you know, a friendly arrangement with a country. They need full control or nothing. And so for 60 years, the U.S. has basically been at war with Cuba for daring to rid themselves of the imperial relationship which they were under prior to the revolution. And so that's the core reason for the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba, you know, and then throw in its strategic importance during the Cold War vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. But I think what is also notable now is that you have Florida, which is obviously a swing state and a very important political state when it comes to national elections. And as a swing state, that means their elections obviously are very close. Almost every presidential election during my time, like since I've been of voting age, Florida, in fact, my first election was 2000 when the entire election swung on Florida. But you know, Florida is one of those states that determines the outcome of presidential elections. And so what you have in South Florida, in the Miami area and Tampa and Fort Lauderdale and elsewhere, is a huge Cuban population that's incredibly conservative. A lot of that is old money from Cuba that came to Cuba fleeing the revolution, that took over industry and took over especially the airwaves. And so the anti-Cuban, anti-revolution propaganda there is incredibly strong. And so it behooves every politician to go to Miami and talk this big game against the revolution and to drum up that support from the South Florida people in an effort to aid themselves electorally later on down the line. I really don't think Donald Trump really knows too much more about the situation other than someone probably told him, hey, if you take an even harder line against Cuba at this point, the Miami people will support you. Mm-hmm. And so I really think that these, you know, it's a effort of his to once again derail one of the few good policies or good reforms that Obama made, so that he can basically say, I do the opposite things of Obama. That's part of how I see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I lived in Canada for 10 years in Manitoba, and then I was deported, and I fought on the deportation for 2 years, and I traveled all across Canada by Greyhound, meeting with people and talking with people. And one thing I found really interesting that I was quite surprised, people on the bus would be showing each other pictures that they had taken on their vacations in Cuba, and you'd never see anything like that here in the United States. And,
no.
You know, I just found that real fascinating, but I think one of the reasons why they don't want people going to Cuba is because, you know, people, the Cuban people are very friendly. I know a lot of Cubans, and I met a lot of the Cuban revolutionaries in Canada. Jose Fernandez was a good friend of mine. He died last winter, but he was one of the leaders of the Cuban Revolution. But all these people are very friendly people, and you know, I think that the United States government is afraid that the American people will go to Cuba and find that friendliness down there, and then they won't be able to demonize the Cuban people. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think that's a factor for sure, because, I mean, Cuban culture is very, very, it's very different than United States culture. It's very warm, and you can tell that most people have that fire in them of the revolution. It's like we were talking about it, Jake and I, and we were trying to figure out what it was. But it's not exactly like everybody lives and breathes the revolution, right? I mean, if they're the older generation, yes, they do. But the newer generation, it's become part of them, right? And so it's in the society as like a sort of freedom. And so they're free of debt. They're free of that worry that we have here in the United States that does limit the possibilities of us interacting with one another, of having leisure time, of all these things that actually help us communicate and feel like a society. And the other thing that I think is that once people from the United States go over there, they're faced with all of the lies that were told to them in the United States about how this country is. And so the truth, I mean, set them free, and then they come back and they're like, I can't believe we're doing this to the poor people from Cuba. This blockade that's been going on for 60 plus years, and they understand what the blockade has done to the country economically, and how the people of Cuba and the government of Cuba, through central planning, have actually created a society with what they have. Even with a society that provides healthcare, that provides education, free education, free healthcare, free housing, all on the blockade. I mean, imagine what we can do here in the United States if we actually implemented something similar, a socialist system similar to Cuba. I think that's one of the main reasons why they don't want us to go over there.
Yeah, they don't want us to see the example of socialism, that's for sure.
I saw an article on Facebook that I guess there was a tornado there, is that right?
Yes.
Right. We actually visited the community where there was the tornado, and then also had an opportunity to visit. So we attended a press press conference where they were going through basically how the response, the disaster response, had been, what, 5 months later, right?
Yeah,
because I think it was in January, and then we went in June,
mm-hmm.
end of June. And following the press conference, then we were able to tour the entire new neighborhood that they had built. So so the tornado had basically torn apart one and
three provinces.
We've gone through three provinces and torn up in like one entire community, basically, mm-hmm. nearby Havana. And 5 months later, they had found housing for, I think, 98% of the people mm-hmm. affected, permanent housing. The remaining 2% were still in a temporary housing, awaiting their new permanent housing, which we were able to go witness. We were able to go see this new
community.
Yeah, it's basically a new rebuilt community. And it was fantastic. Like, and the fact that they had done it in 5 months, you know, in the wake of Katrina, in the wake of Hurricane Maria or Hurricane Harvey and so on, right? Like, you know, we have the reports where people are still living in FEMA trailers, you know, 4 or 5 years later, you know, yeah. People sometimes never come home again. So to see the response, the quick response and turnaround to get the people back into the community and back on their feet within 5 months was truly incredible by a small island nation that's been living under an economic war for all this time.
Yeah. We were allowed and welcome to go into the homes of the people in this new community. And the communities, the government made it a point to try to rebuild the homes and the new little community near, if not at, the place where their house was. And it was just really great. The people welcomed us, and we got to ask them about their experience during the tornado and got some stories. And you know, one of the women that we talked to was just elated to have her new house in May. Like, she moved in May.
Yeah.
And it was great.
So you were free to ask any questions of the people?
Yeah, absolutely.
Where did you stay?
We stayed in Havana in this neighborhood called El Vedado. It's a hotel. It's a state-owned hotel. And then we took 2 days to travel east to Santa Clara. That's it's known as La Ciudad del Che Guevara City, because he was the one that liberated it from the Batista regime. So we stayed there 2 nights, and then we stayed the rest of the time over in La Habana.
So what would you consider the state of democracy in Cuba as compared to here? I know you talked about the situation with the tornado and the rebuilding. You know, we don't see things like that here in this country on our media. But what about the Cuban people? How do they get information about the rest of the world? How informed are they? And, you know, what kind of democracy do they have there?
Yeah, that's a cool question, because you're kind of talking about a lot of the propaganda that we get here in the United States. And, you know, I'll just say before we left, you know, we knew that a lot of it was just propaganda, and that, you know, to take what we had heard with a grain of salt. But, you know, the idea is that, you know, Cuba is a dictatorship, and that people don't have access to music and movies and whatever. It's all crazy talk. Like, everywhere you're going, you're hearing reggaeton, the same reggaeton songs in Cuba that you're going to hear in Miami, that sort of thing. And I just want to touch on the democratic side for a second. Like, you know, their democracy there is different, and we are by no means experts, so we're not quite going to do it justice, but please do. We encourage all listeners to kind of go explore for themselves, to try to seek this information themselves. But so we had an opportunity to sit down with a deputy of the National Assembly. And so the National Assembly is the highest governing body in the country. It's over top of the president. It's over top of the Central Council.
It's unpaid.
Yeah, they're unpaid positions, except for the, I think it's the Central Council or something, who meets year-round. So they're expected to work and carry out their duties as deputies of the Assembly. And so we need to think of their democracy as fundamentally different than ours. Ours is a bourgeois, a capitalist democracy with the decision making ultimately resting within our ruling class, right? And the ruling class knows how to bend the elections, bend the judiciary, bend the legislature, the executive branch, all of that to their will. The Cuban democracy is a proletarian or a workers' democracy. So you have the assembly, so you have deputies going to the assembly and you vote for them in your provinces. So you vote, the way you vote is you basically choose your city leaders. And then your city leaders choose the provincial people to go to the National Assembly. So every province has X number of representatives. And so you don't directly elect the National Assembly, at least in terms of geography. That comes from the municipal leaders that you do have direct elections over. Now, the based on geography, there is also, you can also vote for representation to the National Assembly through your workplace, through your union, through institutions which you utilize or you are a part of. So, you know, so what is that, Committee for the Defense of the Revolution has, it's basically...
Neighborhood associations.
Yeah, neighborhood associations. They send people to the National Assembly. Like I said, your industries, different industries, workers will elect people to send to the National Assembly. Healthcare representatives, education. Mm-hmm. So your institutions, your social institutions, are directly represented there as well. So, you know, it's a different system. It's a little confusing to us who are more used to stuff in the U.S., but you start to get the picture that, hey, wait a second, maybe this would be much, much more democratic in a true democracy sense than the, you know, whatever weird corrupted system we have going here where it's like, we know what the people want, but yet the people never get what the people want. So.
Yeah, do they have, like here we have a bunch of rich people sitting in the House and the Senate and Congress. What kind of people sit in the legislative bodies in Cuba?
Experts.
They're experts in their field,
yes.
Right? And so that can be you're an expert bus driver, you're an expert, or you're a teacher, you're a doctor, you're... somebody who cleans a house, like it's anybody that in your community that the community has faith in, and so they're regular people, they're dressed regular too. Nobody goes all hoity-toity with suits and stuff as to their jobs. We went to a factory. Where we sat with about 15 representatives, including the CEO of the factory, and nobody was dressed above a worker, right? And the other really important thing that I wanted to say is that to become the president of the nation, you have to have been in the National Assembly. So there is none of this jumping and putting money. Like, oh, I feel like running for president today. So our situations that we have here in the United States wouldn't happen there, because you're basically grown into the system.
Yeah. When I was in Canada, I attended several Canadian Labor Congress national conventions, and you know, at each one of those conventions, the Cubans had observers there from their Worker Central Union, and you know, a lot of people don't know that the Cuban unions, I think they have somewhere like 4 million members or something, and
they're
very powerful influence.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any experience meeting with union members, rank and file union members there in Cuba?
Yeah, we visited a factory while we were there, and so yeah, we were able to meet with leaders of the union of that factory, and then go and meet with some of the workers as well, and you know, so they were assembling rice cookers, the particular facility we went to, and I want that job. It was air conditioned in there. People had safety, like
hearing equipment.
Hearing protection. Hearing protection and goggles. And you know, there was an assembly line, and it was moving, but it was moving at a very reasonable pace. It looked to be a pretty doable job. It would get monotonous, like any job can, but yeah, it looked, you know, I mean, it looked like a job I could do for a long period of time. And then also, you know, maternity leave, like, you know, we went through some of the benefits workers get. So basically they have a guaranteed job for life. So even if for whatever reason one particular job isn't working out, they'll figure out how to get them into work somewhere else.
And they will retrain you.
Yeah, and they will retrain you for free, right?
Yeah.
Maternity leave is for a year.
And you basically stop working at 7 months.
Yeah.
And you're paid the whole time.
Yeah, full.
A full
pay.
Year. Mm-hmm.
Everything, like, so what we were discussing with what would essentially be the general manager of the plant, who's sitting there with accountants, who's sitting there with a youth union leader and a regular union leader,
yes,
as well as the Communist Party leader in the plant. And they say legal counsel, they had legal counsel and all this. And, you know, I've been in negotiations for my union where it can get to be a pretty difficult fight. You know, these folks really are just sitting around trying to figure out how to make this work for all parties involved. They all have the goal to produce for the country, to produce, in their case, it's basically electronic appliances. So they have a responsibility to produce electronic appliances. They also have a responsibility to treat the workers fair. The workers have a responsibility to put in a good day's work and, you know, and on down the line. And so to see a firm like that where everybody's basically in alignment, they all obviously have different interests and points of view from what their roles are, but in the end they understand that they all want the same thing and they have to come together to make it happen. It was incredible to see the relationship between labor and management and others in the room. It was pretty crazy. I want to go back to the Democratic side just real quick as well. Is that okay?
Sure, go ahead.
So Cuba also just I think in January as well, February, voted to approve a new constitution. This is their second constitution after 76 and 78.
76. Their first one was in 76.
So it's their first constitution since 76, which was their very first constitution. And I think in 76 they had like
97.8% of the country ratify the constitution. And this time around it seemed like they had 87 or 88% approved the new constitution. Out of 93% of the population voting.
Right.
So you can tell there is dissent. right? Not everybody approved it. Some people, like just like in the United States, they don't vote. But the majority of the people are engaged, right? More than we would see here in the United States. So to pass the Constitution, they started to have community meetings about the Constitution in the whole country a year before. And so the whole population had the ability to go to their CDR, to their Committee in Defense of the Revolution, and propose amendments to the Constitution, talk about and discuss amendments that previous articles or amendments that were in the Constitution that maybe don't fit the society anymore. And so it's a very, very democratic way of involving the society in the future planning of what they want their society to be.
So, yeah, I just wanted to make sure we got that thrown out there, too, that, you know, the Cuban people did just vote, did just participate in and vote on their constitution, whereas we're told that while our constitution is a living document, it's this thing, unalienable thing that is the highest document that's ever existed in the history of the world. Like we can't change our constitution. So I just wanted to put that in there, too. It's another aspect of Cuban democracy that people don't really discuss much.
So what kinds of things does the Constitution protect?
Well, I know that they opened up, like it solidified opening up some private enterprise a little bit. That was one of the major changes that was mentioned. And part of that involves, like, basically, this is a move to ensure that that also it must be kept in mind that change was made with the anticipation that the recent tourism coming from the United States would continue flowing. And since that plug has been pulled, it's really going to be difficult for those private enterprises to make it. But it basically was just people renting out homes or whatever as or rooms as B&Bs, that sort of thing. Some of the other changes, I'm not sure what other changes there were to it. They put in place a new system, I think, of selecting the president, right?
Yeah.
I didn't catch exactly all the details on that, but basically they...
Well, that they can't exceed 60 years old. The president cannot exceed 60 years of age.
No, that's good.
Right? And I'm sorry, I'm here looking at my notes because, I mean, we did learn so much.
So when you were on the street, just walking through the people on the street, did they seem happy, or was there anybody that spoke against the government?
A little bit. So one of the things that we'd heard from people that had gone to Cuba before we ever went there, from one of our good friends especially, but we'd heard it elsewhere too, is that there's nowhere else in the world that women feel more safe.
Walking at night.
Yeah, walking around alone at night, whatever. And it's true. There is, like, no violence there.
No,
there
not
is,
at
like,
all.
We didn't, there was, like, there were not fights, there weren't guns, anything like that. So that's the first thing that you notice is you just really do feel safe.
And we were up pretty late as well. So safer than walking around here.
The people, I mean, they're happy, cool people. Not every single one of them. You can tell that there's issues. People got their issues there, right? We heard a little bit of dissent. One guy we met was talking about how the system, you know, needs to change,
right.
Stuff like that. But, you know, as we continued talking to him, I don't think he really got the picture that, you know, in the U.S., we don't have healthcare for free, right? That blew his mind. He couldn't believe it.
Right, because I was telling him about my brother's wife having a baby and having to pay $60,000.
Yeah, and so, you know, there is some dissent, a little bit. No one seems like, I hate this place, it's horrible. We didn't meet anybody like that.
No, but there is need.
Yeah.
And the need is because of the blockade really affected. And, you know, shipping costs for, let's say, like, concrete, because it's really difficult for them to produce their own concrete, are really astronomical. And the government rations out a certain amount of concrete, but they need even more, right? And so,
due to the shortages, you see black market trade and stuff like that start to develop. And so, you know, the people are incredible. They're so friendly and so, I don't know, warm, I guess.
And they tell you the truth.
and Cuban. I mean, they really just feel like Rachel's family or going to Miami or whatever. They're just Cuban people, too, at the same time. They speak the same way, make the same jokes, have the same pace of their speaking and all that.
Yeah,
so.
I felt really at home, even though, you know, I didn't grow up there. But, like, I was telling Jake, it's insane. Because, like Jake is saying, it feels like home. It feels like Miami. The only thing that's different is ideology. And it's just supremely sad that, you know, there is that divide where a culture is completely, a people are completely split based on that which is fed by propaganda.
Are you going to be traveling around talking about your trip to Cuba?
Oh, I wish.
We have an event set up for August 3rd here in San Antonio.
At Galleria Eva.
Yeah, Galleria Eva on Flores, if anyone.
4
p.m. 4 p.m. Where we're going to give a report back, kind of go through some of the social and democratic institutions that we saw there and met with. And then, yeah, also just share some really awesome pictures and stories. And there's going to be, like, a raffle, silent auction for some higher dollar items, just kind of building some funds for the PSL here, having a good time talking about Cuba, stuff like that. It should be pretty cool.
You want to give people contact information, telephone number or email address or anything?
Email address is satx@pslweb.org. satx@pslweb.org. And then you can find us on Facebook, PSL San Antonio or
SATX. I think it's PSL SATX, or you can just type in PSL San Antonio and we come up there, and you can shoot us a message through Messenger as well.
And there's a event page up on our Facebook as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they talk a lot about Cuba violates human rights. Did you see any kind of human rights violations while you were there?
No.
No.
No. No. No. No.
Not
at all. That's just propaganda. You know. One thing I was thinking about recently, when I started working at my hotel, I'm not from Texas, right? When I started working at my hotel, having gone to college in Texas and learned a little bit about Texas history in college, I noticed that my fellow hotel workers, man, they don't know Texas history. And so I always used to joke with them, like, how are you going to let an American come in here and know more about your history than you know, because they don't know that the Texas Revolution was about protecting slavery and such, right? Anyways, going to Cuba is a little bit sort of like that. Cuba kind of knows our history better than we know our history. And Rachel and I, we know our history pretty well, but at the same time, you know, when we're there, there's a specific museum in Havana, and so if anybody can ever go, they have to go. It's called the Memorial de Denuncia.
Mm-hmm.
De la Denuncia, yeah. Anyways, it's basically set up about the
counter-revolutionary terrorist attacks by the CIA on the island.
Exactly. And so, I mean, it goes through the Bay of Pigs, which they call Playa Iron, which was basically a militia force sent from the CIA to Cuba, right, to try to destabilize and overtake the country. And that's the one that we know about. But then there's, you know, terrorist operations like false flags in Miami,
mm-hmm.
that they would blame on Cuban terrorists,
right.
Like from, like, revolutionary terrorists, but they would actually fund and perform those operations themselves. There's an Operation Peter Pan, if you want to get into that.
Yeah, Operation Peter Pan started in the 1960s, and it was a psychological operation that the CIA initiated in Cuba, and because we have federally funded airwaves of counter-revolutionary propaganda beaming at Cuba, a lot of Cubans believed that their children were going, because of the socialist revolution, that their children were going to be taken away and sent to the USSR to become mincemeat or whatever else. So it's some insane propaganda that the wealthier Cubans that remained on the island believed. And over time, over 20 years, but the height was, I think, during 1962 or 65, 14,000 children, unaccompanied children, were sent from Cuba to Miami to be put into concentration camps and then fostered out. Some till this day don't even know that they're Cuban. And so it's a huge destabilization of culture continuity, of just breaking the island, taking its youth, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the human rights abuses they're from our side, right? Like, and as veterans, we know this. We know that the human rights abuses come from our side. And it's the same thing that we're seeing. So, you know, you take everything that the U.S. is accusing Venezuela of, right? And it's almost all false propaganda. However, all of that exact same stuff that we're accusing of Venezuela is happening in Honduras,
mm-hmm.
which we don't speak a word of, and we don't need to go defend, and we don't need to send aid packages to, and so on. So, you know, it was kind of a through-the-looking-glass experience, despite the fact that we are kind of up, you know, we're people who are up on our history, but even still, Cuba knows our history.
Way better than we do. And, I mean, it's just really interesting, too, because at the museum, the guide was amazing, and he really knows his material, and through him, like, he was like, hey, guys, wake up. Check out the patterns here. The CIA has patterns, and we basically track them. Because at that same museum, we talked to this man. His name is Raul Capote, who was basically recruited and primed by the CIA because he was a college leader, started
artist.
Yeah, he wanted to start his own organization and, like, fix up art in his community and all that during the 1980s. And, right, 1980s?
Yeah.
So the CIA was there, and they were going to recruit him into this 10 to 15-year plan for the island, where he would gain so much respect and momentum that in time he would be the president of the island.
Yeah, he was being cultivated to be this CIA puppet. Like, he was basically being cultivated to be the Juan Guaido of Venezuela.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. How do the Cuban people feel that Trump has said he's going to bring down the Venezuelan, Cuban, and Nicaraguan governments?
They don't think it's possible. I didn't really hear too much about Nicaragua, but the Cuban people that we spoke with, and we didn't get into this too much, but the Cuban people that we spoke with about that topic, they're like, the U.S. can't do anything in Venezuela except cause pain. They can cause pain, and they know that because they've caused Cuba pain, tremendous amounts of pain.
Yeah.
But Cubans know they will not be defeated. And they also know their brothers and sisters in Venezuela will not be defeated. So, it's that revolutionary optimism that they have there. And, obviously the U.S. can pull the most heinous acts and whatever and eliminate the people, right? But that's no victory at all, of course. That's just genocide. So the people know that as long as there's one of them left standing, then they will win.
We've
got a couple minutes left. How's the U.S. aggression in the Caribbean when the Caribbean tries to stay peaceful? How is that affecting them?
We didn't really encounter anything that really. Like anything regarding any aggression elsewhere, there was no real discussion about Haiti or Dominican Republic or maybe a little bit about Puerto Rico, but mostly just in terms of like disaster response and
right.
stuff like that.
Okay. So are there any publications that are in English that the Cubans put out?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's tons of good stuff. Nothing that super comes to mind, but I know that the PSL has just published two books from Cuba. They got the rights to publish these books from Cuba, and one's on Raul Castro, the other one's on Vilma Espín. Both obviously leaders of the revolution.
And they're a couple as well.
Yeah, and so if you go to the PSL web.org, you can find those books there. There's a book, Operation Peter Pan, Operation Mongoose.
Yeah.
Is there any other stuff that you can think of?
There's a lot of things. They were selling, they have their own publications there, and then they were also selling the Ocean published books.
Yeah,
Ocean
Press publishes a lot of good books.
Right, they have a lot of books on Che, like Che's Diary, and Congo,
Yeah,
I read Grandma on the internet sometimes, and that's an English.
Yeah,
Cuba de Late is also a great one. I think they have some articles in English as well.
Sometimes.
They also have this website called Cuba Acusa, one word, cubaacusa.cu, and that's where you see a lot of the footage of terrorist attacks that have happened in the past and how the
okay,
island
we,
has...
We're coming to the end of the show. We're running out of time, but I wish we could talk to you more. Well, maybe we can have you back on again to talk some more about this. We really enjoyed listening to you and appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much
for
having us on. Appreciate it.
Okay. I guess that's it.
Yep, that's it for tonight. Tune in next week, same time.
All right, good night.
Night, take care.
You too.